This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Is it just me, or I feel like I'm not getting much response on this? Big Bird, kind of freaky, no?
He is a little freaky.
Okay, thank you.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me welcoming my guest co-host, the Big Bird of Education Policy, Aaron Churchill.
Well, I'm very excited to be here, Mike. Straight from Ohio. Took the taxi cab in from BWI. Took a little tour of Fort Meade.
Yeah.
Made it about an hour late to the office this morning. I hope that doesn't come out of my salary, right, Mike?
It will not come out of your salary, no. You know, though, I am a little disappointed that you did not take the bus from BWI, Aaron. Aaron is part of our excellent Ohio team. He does work
Thank
in
you.
Columbus doing Ohio policy work, and the team is here in D.C. And Aaron says that his big dream ever since joining Fordham was to come on the Education Gadfly Show. We are going to grant
correct.
You that wish.
That is correct. My dreams have come true. It's like the Make-A-Wish Foundation, I think, today here. So
excellent. Good, good, good. So, you know, Big Bird in the news a lot. Mitt Romney. I'm not sure. I mean, he had a great debate performance. That was probably the biggest mistake he made, was going after Big Bird. People love Big Bird. I personally think he looks a little freaky. But what's your take, Aaron?
Well, I mean, Cookie Monster's nice. If he would have gone after him, I would have been personally offended. Big Bird, not quite as much, I think.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, hey, he is. It's a good thing he didn't go after Elmo. Because then the preschool crowd would have really rebelled.
Oh my gosh, of course, yes.
All right. Well, hey, we got lots to cover today. Let's get started. Ty, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
The University of Arkansas's Jay Green argued in the Wall Street Journal this week that President Obama's pledge to hire more educators addresses an imaginary teacher shortage. Does the teacher workforce need to shrink or expand?
Aaron?
Well, I think, you know, what Professor Green is talking about is substituting some of the labor with capital, and whether that's a possible thing to do with teachers, I'm not quite sure. I'm a little agnostic about whether you're going to get more productivity out of educational technology and bringing blended learning into the classroom. We have some blended learning sites actually in Ohio starting up. We have some digital schools, and they kind of produce results that are hit and miss here and there.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I don't know what your take is, Mike, on you know, whether we can substitute teachers and use capital instead.
Well, you know, before we even get to that question, there's another question, which is, do we need as many teachers as we have today, even for the traditional model? And what you've seen is this huge, huge increase in the number of teachers, but especially in the number of teacher aides and counselors mm-hmm. and specialists, all these warm bodies we have thrown into our schools in the last 10 or 15 years, such that if you just went back to the 1990s level of teachers and teacher other non-teaching staff, you would cut a lot of jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as I recall, the 90s were not exactly the dark ages, and we made mm-hmm. a lot of progress back then in education. So, mm-hmm. You know, I think what Jay and others have been trying to explain is that enrollment growth overall for our public education system has not been huge mm-hmm. in the last 10 or 15 years, but the number of teachers working in our system has just mm-hmm. exploded. So, you know, in a recession like this, we're going to have to go back mm-hmm. down to those levels.
Well, I know certainly in elementary education, when I look at some of the data in Ohio, that there is actually an oversupply of elementary education teachers, certainly. Mm-hmm. And Ohio is one of the net exporters of graduate school, graduates of mm-hmm. school of education, along with Michigan and Ohio. So in our state, we have some oversupply of teachers that's
right.
been, you know, shown by the data. You know, whether there's an oversupply in the math and science, you know, fields is also, I think, a little more debatable.
Right. Fair enough. You know, by the way, if you haven't seen it yet, reader, listeners, you got to check out the Saturday Night Live skit from the debate. Of course, the key line that they had the President Obama make was that he wanted to hire millions and millions of teachers. That was his jobs program. That was funny only because it's only a little bit of a joke. All right. Topic number two.
Aaron, Ohio has struggled with a data tampering scandal this fall. Is the Buckeye State's trouble a sign that accountability has gone too far?
Sure. Well, just some, I guess, a one-minute background of what happened in Ohio. Five districts have been found guilty of data tampering by the auditor of the state of Ohio. Some of those are major public urban public districts, Cleveland Municipal, Toledo. And what they did was, according to Ohio policy, is that for a test score to count, a student test score to count on standardized exams, the test student has to be enrolled from October until the test date in March, continuously enrolled. And so what some of these districts did, Mike and Ty, was they had some administrators break the student record who they thought were basically going to be enrolled and inappropriately disenrolled the student from the system. So those test scores didn't count, and they're typically students of low performing test scores. So it conceivably affected the proficiency rates of those school districts.
Right. So the charge here is that there was just blatant cheating going on. Mm-hmm. Okay. That basically they went in and manipulated the data. Some of the districts are saying, hey, look, what you're overlooking is the fact that there's huge student mobility mm-hmm. here. And we have a study coming out on that
Correct.
Shortly in Ohio that, you know, kids are just moving around like crazy. And mm-hmm. so they actually did disenroll from the system and then maybe came back later in that mm-hmm. year. That does happen more than maybe the auditor understands. But there is clearly allegations of wrongdoing here. Mm-hmm. And some people say, hey, there's no choice here. There's so much pressure, the accountability system. They made us cheat. I mean, this is like teachers mm-hmm. cheating, you know, taking the tests and refilling in the bubbles. Everybody say, oh, we got no choice. All this pressure on us. Do you buy that argument, Aaron?
I don't necessarily buy it. I think that there has to be an accountability framework for every school district in Ohio, whether you're an urban district with a lot of student mobility or you're a suburban district that has relatively stable districts. And I think that to let these urban public districts off the hook just because they have a large student mobility population isn't necessarily an excuse, especially when you're a district like Cleveland that gets about 65% of your funds from the state, and mm-hmm. that there has to be some accountability for those state dollars, the state taxpayers.
Right, and here's the deal. It's wrong. It's wrong to cheat, right?
Yes.
We got to be able to say that. I mean, it's like saying to kids, we're just going to take away all stakes from their lives. You know, you apply for a job. If you lie in your resume, that's wrong. That's high stakes. Are we supposed to say, well, we got to, the problem is the stakes. Well, I'm sorry, getting a job is kind of high stakes, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's going to be times in your life when either you choose to cheat or you do not. And mm-hmm. we need to have a moral code in this country that says cheating is wrong and not to excuse it by saying, well, the stakes were high.
Yes, and certainly I hope the Auditor General comes down hard on these districts and
Absolutely.
People who are doing that.
Absolutely. Keeping in mind that, you know, there could be instances where the kids bouncing
Correct.
Around actually did happen.
Right.
And that's one of the crazy
Correct.
Things that's happening.
And it's very
system.
Hard to determine that, and the auditor is sorting through some of that.
All right, good. Topic number three.
Schools in San Antonio have begun using student IDs to track students' location. Is this a useful attendance accountability tool or an invasion of privacy?
So, Aaron, I love this. I guess this means what? There's some kind of chip, and it follows the kids around, and you can, go on a computer and figure out, are they at school, or are they hanging out in the woods smoking pot, or are they at the McDonald's and having a Big Mac? I mean, is this a good thing? Has this gone too far?
Well, haven't you ever gotten a package from China before? I think this is how they track the packages. They use these RFID tags that are radio frequency identifiers for a package, and you can track where the package goes from here to here to here. Whether we want to consider our students UPS packages is mm-hmm. a debatable question. And the article in the New York Times brings that up, and there's some concern about whether students should be treated like cattle that have these RFID tags
yeah,
on
yeah.
them to make sure that they're pasturing in the right pasture.
Yeah, I mean, the you know, it's like an ankle bracelet or something that we put on prisoners. But how does it actually work, Ty? I mean, do they staple it to the kid, or is it in their ID? It seems like it would be pretty easy for the kids to just give it to a friend if they were going to go skip school, and their ID might sit in the school or in their locker, but it wouldn't actually be where the kid is.
As you well know, in lots of schools, but particularly in urban schools, a lot of schools have instituted policies where students need to wear IDs at all times. So it's not actually, you know, that difficult for principals to enforce students having these on them at all times.
I think, you know, piercings are very popular today. I think we could put the chip in some kind of piercing and boom, there, you got it done.
Well, are we headed to 1984 these days?
Oh, absolutely. This is not surprising. And actually, I would think there's already devices like this for parents of younger kids. If you want to, you know, as a child safety thing, your child goes missing, you go up online and quickly figure out where they are. But this does certainly raise all kinds of privacy concerns. I worry about the kind of school cultures that we have in schools that feel like they must do this. Mm-hmm. You know, these are places where there's not a lot of personalization. I mean, if, you know, there's always this adage, especially around middle schools and high schools, that every child in that building should be known well by at least one adult, and that adult would notice if they weren't there that day. You know, this is a technological solution, but the point is not so much just whether they're there. The point is that there's relationships, and that those relationships are really important to get kids to come to school and to learn and to stay motivated and all of that. So I have to say, if you're using this in your school, I'm worried about that. You know, maybe it's something like metal detectors, right? You say, you know, nobody really wants to use metal detectors. Maybe people feel like they have to as a method of last resort. I sure hope that the, you know, stapling an ID to a kid is a method of last resort.
Mm-hmm. But as a method of last resort, when I was teaching, my students who had had interactions with the juvenile justice system and were on ankle monitoring bracelets, they came to class because they had to.
And did they participate enthusiastically?
Hey, first step is kids coming to class.
All right. Excellent. Very good. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Aaron. Thank you, Ty. That was fun. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
I have a very serious question for you.
All right, I'm ready.
Big Bird, what's your take?
Woo! You know, I think I wasn't too hard on Romney for saying that. You know, I mean, I don't know how much money PBS gets, but can it be supported without federal money?
Well, the thing is, as people point out, that Sesame Street now is supported without federal money. I assume by selling, millions and millions of Elmo dolls and other things like that. But some of the other shows are still supported. Is it just me, or I feel like I'm not getting much response on this? Big Bird, kind of freaky, no?
He is a little freaky.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate you saying that. That makes me feel a lot
better.
He wasn't
my favorite Sesame Street character. I like the one, who's Grover? That's on the trash can, right?
Or
who's
Oscar the Grouch.
Oscar's in the trash can, yes. Mm-hmm. I like him.
All right, fair enough. Okay, what you got for us this week,
Amber?
It
was a little dry in Ed Research land, so I went back to old EEPA archives. And over the summer, there was a semi-interesting study on...
Boy, you're really selling it. Here, Amber. I love how you sell it.
I know. Anyway, a couple of UNC researchers examined the effects of subgroup-specific accountability on student achievement. So this was back when, you know, there was a lot of talk of the ESE waivers and that they were going to be allowing super subgroups. So there was some concern that this might mask the performance of some subgroups of kids, while others were saying, you know, we need these super subgroups that are going to be beneficial because a lot more kids will be in them, because sometimes we ignore kids because the end size is too small, so they don't get counted anyway. So anyway, this was kind of trying to deal with, you know, as the super subgroup argument. Analysts used data from multiple cohorts of grade 3 through 8 students in North Carolina between 2000 and 2008. It's about 1.7 million students in 1,800 schools. So they find that the scores of poor and minority students improved more on average after NCLB was implemented than before. We kind of knew that. Also, if their subgroup failed AYP the year before, they saw moderate improvement the next year. They used a variety of statistical models to determine that this was the result more likely of the subgroup specific accountability than from failing a more generalized AYP target. The differences were small for Black and poor students, but larger for Hispanics, larger positive effects for the lowest achieving schools rather than the schools on the margin, which was kind of interesting because usually we talk about the bubble kids and there's more attention paid to those kids. Some evidence of adverse effects for low and high achievers in math but not reading, and they kind of attribute that to an increase in the rigor of math standards in 2006. Some discussion at the end about, you know, how should we take this whole subgroup accountability bit. They suggest, as we know, that performance growth for kids at various points of the achievement distribution is better than using this sort of static proficiency measure for each subgroup. So there you have it.
You know, I think from a branding perspective, super subgroup is one of the best terms that we've seen in a long time in the education policy
world. Better than reform realism, though?
Well, come on, let's not get crazy now, Amber. No. But, it does have alliteration, which is always one of my rules.
It does.
It has to have alliteration. So. Absolutely. No, so this is helpful, perhaps. I guess we'll see how this plays out now as these super subgroups are used in some places. Although it's so confusing, the policy is that you're sort of allowed to use super subgroups, but you still kind of got to use the other subgroups too. It's so opaque. I wonder if schools have any idea what they actually have to do to hit their new targets every year.
Right.
In Ohio, is it clear to schools, do you think, that when they know, okay, I got to get 10 more kids over this bar in order for me to make the NCLB goals, or is it just totally confusing, do you think?
I don't think the sense I get from the schools is that they do their best with what, you know, NCLB requires with the Black kids. the Hispanic kids, the English language learners, mm-hmm. the special education kids, and whether or not these super subgroups within these subgroups is worth parsing out to the districts, and mm-hmm. whether the cost of doing that is worth it, I think is mm-hmm. up for grabs, and whether a district can easily implement that and teach to those super mm-hmm. subgroups is also, I think, debatable and costly.
Yeah, I think this kind of showed what we knew, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if a subgroup fails, guess what? The school starts paying attention and tries to do better with those kids.
Right, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
And I have to say, as somebody who has been supportive of super subgroups, not only because mm-hmm. of the cool name, mm-hmm. But because of the idea of trying to look... allowing states to be flexible, that you have this situation in some places where, the problem of 32 different categories of kids that could fail, and you want to try to create a system where it just makes more rational sense. But all that said, you don't want to lose this mechanism whereby they're paying attention to kids that may not otherwise be paid attention
to. Right. And the NSAS seems a valuable argument, right? I can't remember what the NSAS was with NCLB.
It was up to the states. That was the
deal. Yeah, that's right. So some, had 32 or 35 and some had 5.
And then there were confidence intervals. There was all this different statistical
manipulation. Maybe there is an argument here that, those 5, kids who were some obscure, subgroup will get, aggregated into the larger one, and maybe that'll do some good.
Right.
I don't know. Seems like to make sense on the face of it.
Right. But you throw on top of that value added, it just gets incredibly complicated. So hopefully the message to schools is, hey, this is such a complicated system, there's no way you can figure it out, so you just got to help everybody do a lot better.
Right.
And maybe you'll survive.
Yes.
And if not, you might get shut down and, get sent to Cuba.
No.
All right. Good. Well, Amber, let's hope. I have this worry that researchers out there, they're sitting on their research thinking they can't get attention for it during the election. They should not assume that.
I know. Because I will feature it in the Research Minute if you send it to me. And
boom.
It's good.
There it is. And guys, let's face it. That is about as good as you can expect
Woo-hoo!
These days for education research. All right, Amber. Thank you. Aaron, it is a pleasure.
Thank you. It's my privilege.
I hope next time you're in D.C., look us up. Come on by. Join us again.
Absolutely.
Until next week.
I am Aaron Churchill.
And I'm Mike Petrilli, the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.